I'm Catherine.
And I'm Sarah.
We love languages and learning.
And we're curious about the intersection of language diversity and learning and development in corporate and higher ed spaces.
We want to know, why is language accessibility for all important in learning environments? What does it look like when all languages are treated equitably? And what does the future hold for multilingualism in L&D?
Join us in this podcast as we talk with experts about all things L&D and language.
This is L&D Loves Languages.
So our guest today is Carly Overfelt. Carly has been teaching in higher education for over 15 years, especially courses in writing, literature, ESL, and linguistics. She has experience with faculty-facing programming and has been part of linguistic diversity curriculum and program initiatives at three different higher ed institutions so far. What she learned in this work, especially from working with students, inspired her book project, tentatively titled Language Diversity in Higher Education, Where to Start and How to Push, a faculty and student-facing resource on how to start working towards linguistic diversity and linguistic justice in higher education in the classroom and on the campus at large. Carly, we're so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate both of you for this opportunity. Yeah, it's just great. Thank you.
Yeah, so happy to have you here. Nice to meet you.
Thanks.
Yes, this will be great. So we'll just dive in with our first question, which is, what is your language story?
I love this question. My language story is that I am from very rural Arkansas. And so I grew up speaking, you know, the variety of English that we're used to in that, you know, part of the South. And so this is where I like to let people know, if they don't know already, and sometimes they do, that there are multiple Southern Englishes. And I like to tell people that where I'm from, and you may not hear it today because my brain is very much feeling like in official English mode right now, so you may or may not get to hear it, you know, today. But the English that I grew up speaking is not really the Southern Belle Gone with the Wind Southern English, but I like to tell people it's more like a Billy Bob Thornton, you know, English. When people still know who that is, sometimes people don't know who that is. Or Bill Clinton, you know, so Bill Clinton, you know, is from Arkansas, so that's a little bit more similar to what I grew up speaking. And of course, I'll be sharing this podcast episode out with friends and family and colleagues, and I know that there will be someone, more than one person where I'm from, who maybe thinks to themselves, Carly, if you were speaking, you know, Arkansas English, what was I speaking? Because I was not even, you know, my family was not even the most, I would say, like, typical or prominent, you know, users of what we might think of as kind of an Arkansas English. And even within the state, you know, folks were maybe more or less close to what we might call a standard American English. So, you know, I grew up identifying with, you know, being Southern and maybe speaking Southern dialects, maybe kind of how I thought of it. And, but also knowing that I grew up with people who were maybe even more far from the so-called, I'm doing air quotes, you know, standard, even than, you know, we were in my family for maybe a host of different reasons, which I suppose make up my language story. So those reasons would be things like, I identified really early on as a reader and a writer. So I used to write stories and poems and all kinds of things. I was, this is going to sound kind of braggy, but I was just kind of a nerd introvert kid. And so I was always reading, you know, maybe above, you know, the grade level, yeah, perhaps that I was mm-hmm. expected to. And I really leaned into that as part of my identity. And so I was aware really early on that the English that I heard around me and that maybe even was using was pretty different from what I was reading, you know, in novels. And I mean, I was reading Shakespeare really early, you know, I probably because it was a challenge in some ways. And for me, that felt good and felt right and was really early on a part of my identity as someone who could read and write and really was attuned to language and using language well. So that's a big part of my language story. I think I did study languages in college and in graduate school. I studied German actually in high school. The place where I'm from, historically, there were a lot of settlers from Germany, German immigrants. Actually, Arkansas has a lot of that history. And so at my tiny school, whoever happened to know another language would teach the foreign language class, the single foreign language class. And because of this German connection, we actually had a teacher whose family was German historically, and so she taught German in high school. And then actually the very end of high school, we ended up having a Spanish teacher because she retired. And so I continued with German in college, which was really enjoyable. And, you know, it's so close to English that it's just a really fun language for English speakers to learn, I think, because you can get those wins, you know, pretty early on. And then I studied French in graduate school and a little bit of Spanish. I'm kind of coming back to Spanish a little bit on Duolingo. And it's just, you know, we know that that, you know, is so enjoyable to explore different languages. And, you know, sometimes it's for a specific purpose, but sometimes it's just for the fun and joy of it, you know, and to just expand, you know, our horizons. But because I was so, I had such a strong identity as, you know, a reader and a writer and all of that, I was kind of a prescriptivist about English at first. And I think that's part of my language story too. As I transitioned from, you know, high school to, you know, early years of college, that was something that, you know, was kind of important to me to think about what's the best English or what's the correct English. And we can talk more about that maybe in future questions, but that's kind of the short version of my language story. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh, Carly. I think Sarah and I and you, like the Venn diagram of our like early language lives, our early language stories is like basically a circle. Like there's, we've talked about that, about how like we also had similar experiences of, you know, being voracious early readers. Mm-hmm. And as you, the word that you use is prescriptivist, which is like perfect, like which is the right, which is the best, the most precise word to use in this context. That's, yeah, we can relate to that. And definitely talking about standard English versus non-standard English and who decides is such a rich, that's a rich conversation to have. This is going to segue beautifully into our next question, which is how did your language skills shape your career path?
Yeah, right. And so I will start with, you know, my undergraduate experience, because I feel like that's where so many of us, that is kind of the beginning, you know, of our career path and how we find ourselves where we end up, you know, later. And for me, you know, I always wanted to be a teacher when I was, you know, a kindergartner. I wanted to be a kindergarten teacher. When I was a first grader, I wanted to be a first grade teacher, and so on and so forth. And then when I got to college, I was like, oh, this is it. Like, I belong here. I'm going to be a college professor. Okay. And so I identified with my professors. And the reason that I mentioned that is because where I went to school was really close to, you know, where I'm from. And, you know, that was on purpose. I went to the closest school that I got, you know, the financial aid package that would make that possible for me. And we were full of folks just like me, like people from like rural areas, first generation college students. So it's not that I didn't have peers that I felt were like me, but it's more that I wanted to be like my professors, and they were different, and they were from different places. They spoke differently than the rest of us did. There was even sometimes kind of a feeling of distance between us and them. It felt like, and especially I was an English major, which I should have maybe led with that. But so that context of there is a right English, there is a best English, there's an academic English, there's an English that professors use. So pretty early on, you know, if I didn't have to have anyone say this to me out loud, I understood without someone saying it, I cannot speak the way that everyone where I'm from speaks and do this as a profession. It's not something that I can do. And I remember kind of struggling with that a little bit. And again, people where I'm from, if you're listening to this, you're like, really, Carly, you've had to struggle to sweat, you know, have you heard my grandma? Like, have you heard my family? And I get it 100%. So if you can imagine if I felt like that, I mean, think about, you know, folks who maybe grew up even, you know, more quote unquote, air quotes, non-standard even than my family did. But I got that message early on that I needed to make a change. And I remember specifically an example where I was trying to make the switch from my sister's name is Kelly. So instead of saying, like, me and Kelly went shopping, switching to Kelly and I went shopping. And I remember, like, having to get used to it physically coming out of my mouth because it felt to me the height of pretentious things to say. Like, I just couldn't believe it, but I knew I had to do it. And so I worked on it and I practiced and I got there. And that's just one example, but that's how I felt. And so I worked towards that. And then I took my first intro to linguistics class. And we all know what happens after that. You start to understand that this is all crap, you know, right? and none of that matters. And that it's power dynamics. It's some of it's accidents of history. Some of it is the continued and very purposeful oppression of groups of people. It's about class, race, gender, you know, you name it. And so that's, but it was hard for me to accept that. It was uncomfortable information to understand really how language works, like truly how it works. And so that's when I started getting interested in sociolinguistics and that kind of thing. And that's what led me to study linguistics. So I did a master's degree in linguistics at Purdue University. And that's where I got kind of some theoretical background. And I was teaching ESL at that time. And I remember, and this is doesn't have any particular point except to just help illustrate the journey, but I remember teaching ESL and I was talking to students who were, many of them were from Korea and China and places that felt very far away and different from me. And I asked them to write a sentence on the board, and they did not know what word I was saying. Even in the context, they did not know what word I was saying. I finally wrote sentence on the board and they said, oh, sentence. They're like correcting me. So even like at that point, you know, I was still kind of undergoing this, you know, shift. And so to be an ESL teacher, you have to think about, you know, when we think about our language skills and background and how it impacts our career, ESL teachers and tutors are under pressure to perform a certain kind of English for their students and teach them a certain variety of English to be successful in that field, which, I mean, mostly for me, it was just funny, you know, it was just like funny anecdotes, but we can imagine how that can also be, you know, a barrier sometimes for some folks. So that's, those are some ways when I think about my language background and how that impacted my career path. In terms of skills specifically, I think, you know, that focus on thinking about reading and writing as a skill and crafting different Englishes for different contexts is something that clicked with me early on and was definitely an asset for me kind of moving through the career path. And I'll tell you the rest of my career path, and I won't pause, you know, every 2 seconds to dive too much into everything. But from there, I did a PhD in the English department at UMass Amherst, and I was focused on the way that so-called non-standard and non-native, and I'm always doing the air quotes, Englishes, plural, are represented in American fiction of the long 19th century. And so the reason I was looking at that time period is because their ideas about English and what it means to be American and sound American from that era that inform directly our current moment. And so that for me was an important moment to kind of zoom in and look at. And I had, so I was in the English department. I had a relationship with the linguistics department and at one point had folks from them on my committee. And then when I finished, I had Jonathan Rosa, who's now at Stanford, was on my committee. And he is a linguistic anthropologist slash educational linguist, I think is he would heavily identify maybe more on the educational linguist side. And, you know, just learned about how all of this connects to the education system more. And that really changed my career path because I could see everything that I was thinking about for the validity of different Englishes and the way that they are represented often in classist and racist ways in our culture was directly related to pedagogy. Like we're thinking about that in our teaching. And so that led me down a path of using that background. And, you know, we do a lot of teaching when we do PhDs in the English department. We're teaching writing, we're teaching literature, we're teaching everything. And so it all just came together really well for me. And so I took that, you know, so that's kind of what I specialize in now, is thinking about how we can do our best in higher ed pedagogy and programming to support those students, not just students like I was, but students who are even more vulnerable, and especially students who are racialized through their perceived language difference. Sometimes it's real, sometimes it's perceived, you know, language difference. And so that's kind of where I'm at now in my career. So, yeah.
That is fascinating.
Oh, thanks.
Really?
That really is. I would just love to sit down and ask you all the questions about your PhD and studying the literature. Oh, that sounds amazing. I know it's not quite the focus today, but I had to just say that.
Yeah, oh, thanks.
You've sort of talked a little bit about what it looks like for you to use your languages in work, but if there's anything else you want to add to that, and also a follow-up question would be, what role, if any, does technology play?
Yeah, that's a great question. I find that I'm mostly using what many scholars would call mainstream white English. And I purposefully am naming that because that's one thing that we think that we know helps kind of resist the ideas about standard English is to just kind of name things. If that's what we're talking about, then let's call it what it is. And so that's usually what I'm, you know, using at work. And I do find opportunities to craft in writing what I think of as a more formal academic language, although that's certainly a construct, you know, as well in many ways. So I do still research and write, but often I'm using more informal, you know, English. I have found as my confidence and just being in the space that I'm in and writing about what I write about and doing what I do, I do kind of slip is maybe not the right word. I sometimes am my authentic linguistic self at work. And, you know, sometimes I don't feel comfortable doing that and will correct myself, but it's usually a sign that I'm feeling comfortable with who I'm speaking to. And then other times I just refuse. Maybe it's the end of the day and I'm tired and I'm just going to say what I'm going to say. And then things like y'all, you know, it's the gender neutral plural you that we've always needed and deserved in English. And, you know, every part of the country has solved this in some different way. So, you know, we have places, I think in Pennsylvania, you know, you can hear yins. You can hear in places in the Northeast, like yous or yous guys. I think use is Chicago. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that, folks. But and you know, you guys is certainly one that we use, but we think of that as not gender neutral. Although I'm sure most of the time when people are using that, they're thinking of it as gender neutral. But people can experience it as gendered, which is valid and important. So it's good to try not to do that, you know, depending on what we're doing. And so y'all, it just works. And so I spread that, and maybe I'll ask you too what you think about y'all, because there was definitely a time, I've been teaching long enough in higher ed that I can say there was a time when my students connected y'all with the South. And now that time is over. So, and also maybe place. So when I was in Massachusetts teaching, students definitely connected it with the South. And then when I've been teaching in Michigan, students are like, no, I mean, people in California use y'all, people in Michigan use, like, it's just the thing that you say. So I'd love to hear what you two think about that. But that's one thing that I've brought into my workplace.
Sarah, you want to go first? What do you think about y'all?
I was going to say, I very much feel like I used to hear it and think of it as strictly a Southern term, but that's shifted too. Mm-hmm. Like in recent years, I've just started thinking of it, as you said, as the, you know, inclusive plural you. And I almost feel like I started noticing that around the same time I started noticing people say folks, like, hi, folks. Mm-hmm. And maybe just in the groups of people I was talking with, but that was sort of what I noticed. It was really interesting to hear you say that, Carly, about how there's been a shift.
Yeah.
And Catherine, what have you seen or heard?
So I'm in Connecticut, uptight, WASPy Connecticut. Not that all of Connecticut is WASPy. That is not the case. But my family is like the family I grew up in, definitely is white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And interestingly, I was born in Connecticut, but my whole family is actually from Indiana and has also, and then moved out of Indiana into like different parts of the South, Texas, Florida, Georgia, Arkansas for a little bit. And so I grew up hearing a lot of y'all, but could never adopt it as my own. Like it just felt wrong. And also interestingly, Carly, I went to college undergrad in Indiana in Bloomington. And I know we have some overlap. I was listening to you speak and I was like, oh my gosh, we have a lot of like echoes of things. But I hear it more now. I hear it more now than I used to. It definitely used to be when I was growing up that in Connecticut that you couldn't really use y'all. Like people would kind of make fun of you for using y'all, but it feels, it doesn't feel quite so regionalized to the way that it did back then. But at the same time, I don't really feel like I can use it in an authentic way, but I feel weird saying you guys. So a lot of times I just kind of say you. Like I just say you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I even, could there be anything more like uptight than saying, what do you all think? Because I definitely do. I don't contract it. Like I just say the whole phrase, you all, which could there be anything more like New England-y and uptight? Like, I don't know. Like, what am I from like the Back Bay? Am I like a Boston Brahmin? Like I'm not, but sometimes it does feel like I can't. Like there's a folksiness of y'all that feels inauthentic to me. And I'm, it's interesting. I'm glad that you asked the question because I was sitting here thinking about it and I was like, I don't think I've ever used y'all naturally. And be that as it may, like maybe I'll get hate mail, probably not, but I don't know. It doesn't, for whatever reason, like the particular time and place that I grew up, and maybe socioeconomic class probably has something to do with it too, but it never stuck in my vernacular, my own vernacular.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's definitely infiltrated the Midwest for sure. And I mean, I use it now even like in meetings with faculty and other staff. And I mean, one reason is because I feel well equipped to argue with anybody who has an issue or wants to say something about it. So I feel very privileged in that way. And then also it just works and it's functional. It's like, why am I fighting this? You know, like I will show everyone how useful this is. but I do hear it quite a bit.
All right. So Carly, on to our next question. I feel like you're setting us up for these questions because they're incredible. They're incredible segues from one topic to the next. How do language power differentials reveal themselves in your organization? And how does that impact your L&D work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I will answer it talking maybe about higher education institutions generally. And that's kind of my expertise, is kind of helping people think through that. And some of it I've seen, you know, firsthand, maybe a little bit of it experienced as a student, although the stakes were fairly low for me as a white woman, but certainly have learned from students over the years about what they experience. In higher ed, in the classroom, outside of the classroom, every now and then it'll make a little news story. So, for example, without naming specifics, it wasn't that long ago that there was a story that hit the headlines where a few students from, I believe, China were speaking Mandarin in the hallway at their institution. And this, you know, was something that some, at least one faculty member really was uncomfortable with and complained. And even there was some suggestion that this student could maybe even miss out on, you know, I think it was a research internship or some kind of opportunity, or should they be having letters of recommendation written for them? There was some sense of, you know, there was high stakes for how this person behaved linguistically on their own time with a fellow, you know, Mandarin speaker in the hallway. And so we know that there is a lot to talk about when it comes to language and power in higher ed. And that's just one, you know, kind of example of that. But this is kind of baked in, really, to assessment in higher education classrooms when we think about how much our students are using language to show what they know in the class. They're doing that when they speak in classroom discussion. They're doing that when they do presentations. And certainly, of course, writing. They're writing research papers, they're writing reflection papers, they're writing discussion posts. They're writing a lot, you know, and the point of it usually is to show what they know. I mean, there are a lot, that's one of the best ways to find out what somebody knows. If you can talk about something in your own words and answer questions about it, and we need language to do this stuff, then that's how I can tell if you know the thing, you know, or not. And so peeling apart what it is students are able to show you that they know from this bias that we all hold, and that's me too, towards different Englishes or ways of, you know, using English, can be really difficult and really a challenge. And, you know, I've alluded to before that for some of us, that's, the stakes are fairly low. Certainly, once you bring race into the question, the stakes often are much higher because those students are already, you know, being racialized, as scholars mm-hmm. would say, on the campus. And, you know, there are some scholars of a kind of, I was going to say emerging, but it's been a few years now, of raciolinguistics. So that's like R-A-C-I-O, linguistics. And those scholars argue that actually you can't separate that stuff. So when we mm-hmm. are racializing folks, what we think we hear and see from them in their language is inherently a part of that process. And so that's something that our students are facing all the time, and it can lead to unequal educational outcomes. It can lead to students feeling like they don't belong, you know, and even in their language classes. You know, I had a student who was multilingual and spoke Spanish as part of her heritage and was in a Spanish class. And I don't remember what the example was, and maybe that's better, but her professor told her, no, no one says it like that. She got corrected in class. No, no one says it like that. Because she was kind of taking, I think, maybe Spanish, upper level Spanish courses, you know, to just, you know, dive into her Spanish, you know, heritage even more. And this was really painful for her. And it may not have affected her grade necessarily. It was kind of a one-off comment. But it sends a message to students, and they feel that. And that's where the power differential comes in. That student is not going to necessarily feel equipped to argue with that, or even they may even just believe it, right? Okay, my right. family doesn't use Spanish correctly, you know, like, and I chuckle at it just because it feels so outrageous, not because it's funny, but just the outrageousness of that. So that's something that, you know, we know is happening. The good news is that a lot of folks are writing about this, and there are a lot of resources out there. There's a book coming out, I think in a couple of months, specifically about how to grade student writing in higher ed in a way that is linguistically inclusive. And the last name of that author is escaping me right now, but I can share that if you're doing show notes and that kind
yes.
of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes,
and
please.
So I think a lot has been written about being linguistically and culturally responsive in the classroom K through 12. I'm thinking about like Django Paris and H. Samuel Lim and April Baker yeah. Bell and other folks. And of course, a lot of people before them that their work really depends on and rests on. But in higher ed, there's just not as much. But that is changing, and that is good. I'm trying to help change that with my book. And the book, which is now tentatively titled Language Diversity in Higher Education, hopes to, A, you know, dive into a little bit about, you know, what language really is and how it works, kind of like Ling Crash Course 101, and that moves into some common myths about language, especially as it touches students' lives, and common concerns about that. So, for example, oh, well, someday they're going to have job interviews, and it's important for me to, you know, behave in a certain way towards them now so that they're not surprised later. So, we, you know, I address that in the book. And then it moves to supporting students in the classroom, and then it moves to campus support. So, like, thinking about the campus broadly and how folks can come together to work to support students. And that doesn't mean that those power differentials go away, though, of course. And so it's a long road ahead of us. And I guess something that I should add to that is that it's not just about students. I mean, this is also a faculty-to-faculty, you know, bias, faculty-to-staff. I can think of, I don't know how much you want me to pause and tell stories, but I can think of a time on a campus I won't name, and I've been on a lot of campuses, so it's safe for me to do those things. But a man was giving a presentation, and he was probably, you know, late 30s or something, white man going to give a presentation. And part of the presentation to the staff, this is a staff context, part of the presentation to the staff was a short video in which a young white woman was speaking. And so he's illustrating something. He starts to play this video. She starts to say the word like. She says something, something like, and she says like again, and she says like again. And we can predict what happens. People start fixating on how many times she said like. No one's listening anymore to the thing that they're supposed to be paying attention to in this demonstration. By the time this clip is done playing, people are just laughing. There's just laughter all in the room. Okay, so the video ends. It's back to the person doing the presentation. He gives a kind of, you know, nervous chuckle, like trying to, get things transitioned back to what he was talking about. So he starts to talk about, you know, bringing us back to the point. He says like. He says like again. He starts to notice he's doing that. The room starts to notice he's doing that. No one even noticed this was happening when he was doing it before. He didn't change how he was speaking. It's that we weren't expecting that from him. We weren't primed for that. And then when we hear it from this young woman, you know, the way young women's speech is always policed and always, you know, derided. Anything that we can associate with young women is always, you know, going to end up being stereotypically silly or frivolous or too much. And that was like one of the best examples. I share this example a lot because I think it's so powerful to think about how baked in this is to our experiences and how when we look at someone, we can already hear them or not, right, in certain ways. And so that was a student in the video. And so it's about students, but it's also about staff, and it's about faculty, and it's, you know, about our bigger context, you know, as well. So this stuff is always at work. And so it's on us to kind of try to be paying attention to that.
I really appreciate you sharing these stories. The stories are great because they so illustrate your points, and also, you know, really highlighting what you spoke about in terms of evaluation and assessment, and how there's the biases about language there, even though language is sort of the filter through which, in a way, the knowledge is being expressed, potentially. I mean, I know it's a little more complicated than that, but also, you know, like the story about the, what you just were saying, the story about the like and the, you know, this shows up everywhere, how we're teaching, how we're working, how we're building relationships, what's viewed as professional. I used to work in a writing center on another campus, and anytime discussions of linguistic diversity came up and how to assess student writing versus support student writing and finding their own voices, there was always that comment, like you said, well, what about when they're being evaluated by someone who doesn't understand like we do? Well, maybe there's a bigger issue at play here.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. Yeah. It's pretty much the number one kind of thing that comes up when I present about this or write about it or even just have conversations with people about it. And I borrowed something from a keynote. I went to a conference a couple weeks ago and listened to a really great keynote by Kate Denial, whose whole thing is Pedagogy of Kindness. And she got a similar version of, you know, a little bit of pushback in the Q&A. I won't go too much into what her expertise is, but Pedagogy of Kindness, you can kind of imagine a little bit about what that's about, and believing students and trusting them and meeting them where they're at and being kind to yourself and all that. And someone said, well, the world isn't kind. They're going to get outside of our classrooms and the world is not kind. And she said, I'm never really going to be, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but she said, I'm never going to be very persuaded by an argument that I should treat students poorly now because they're going to get treated poorly later. And I think we can very safely substitute phrasing of, I'm never going to be persuaded to discriminate against students now because they're going to be discriminated later against later. It's just, that doesn't work. And if we think about, you know, would we allow blatant gender discrimination in our classrooms because that's going to happen later? I mean, maybe there are some folks out there who do think that way. I don't think they would say that out loud. But for some reason, when we talk about language, we feel very safe in that. And I say for some reason, there are a lot of very well-known reasons why. And it's because it's a proxy often for that gender discrimination or discrimination along, you know, racial lines, even if we're not aware of that taking place.
Yeah. Wow. I couldn't agree more.
Yes. And I think that very nicely leads us into our concluding question. And actually, I should mention, Carly, I forgot to say this because there were so many other things I wanted to comment on. I'm very, very excited to read your book when it comes out. So
thanks.
Looking forward to that.
Yes. That too.
Yes. So with that in mind, along with your book, what does the future hold for multilingualism in L&D?
I hope that the future is very bright. I think some of the issues I outlined and that you gave me such an excellent platform to kind of delve into, you know, today, is really coming. I think that stuff is really coming to light more than it used to. I'm just, again, just thinking about even my own students. There was a time when if I wanted to help them understand what, for example, African-American English is, or African-American language, as April Baker Bell terms it, if I wanted to explain to them what that is, I would have students who just, in a very literal and basic sense, had no idea what I was talking about. And now that's not the case. I have students, when I have them maybe introduce themselves, you know, on discussion boards or talk about their linguistic background as part of their intro about themselves, I have students self-identifying as AAE speakers right there. And it's amazing. And so a lot is changing. I think people are valuing different, not just different languages, but different Englishes and different ways of using language. Social media, I think, is a big, you know, part of that. So I'm excited about the future. Something I thought about, too, when you asked that question is, I think we're going to have a complex relationship with AI in the future. I think that's part of the future as well. I think I'm thinking about, at the conference I mentioned a moment ago, someone was giving a demonstration about how good this AI translation is getting, like in videos. So this speaker uploaded a video of himself saying something in Japanese because he's American, but he also speaks Japanese. He uploaded a video of himself saying something very short in Japanese, and the program then gave it back to him in English translation, and even mimicked the movements of his face and lips that would go along with that. But guess what? He had like this, as he termed it, posh British accent, and he did. So I think that there's still going to be a place to be thinking about, what's going on with language, and it's never going to be a perfect, you know, translation. But I think as that stuff gets better, I think maybe our relationship with multilingualism is going to be a little bit different, and maybe even become more prestigious, because it's going to be perhaps connected with relationship building, and you didn't have to maybe take the time to learn this other language for your work because our tools are so advanced. And I'm thinking way in the future, our tools are so advanced now, you didn't really have to do that, but you did it, and you had the time and leisure to do that because you wanted to go that extra step to connect with either your coworkers or the country you live in or whatever it is. So I'm not really sure, but I think AI is going to be part of this future. I personally have a complex relationship with that, maybe a little ambivalent in some ways. Yeah. But yeah, so, but I think there's good stuff coming for sure.
I love your optimism. I love your optimism. I'm gonna get on that bus too. I'm gonna be, and I agree. I'm not sure about my relationship with AI either. Complex is a good word for it. I mean, I think we have to have a lot of care and intention in the way that we leverage AI, especially when it comes to interpersonal relationships and like cross-cultural communication. We have to take a great deal of care in that. But yeah, I love your optimism. So
great. I love it.
I'm going to join in on that.
Yeah, I do. I like the optimism too. I love your comment that, you know, we could potentially, learning another language could mean even more because you didn't need to, but you did anyway. Like that's very interesting to think about.
How nice would it be to have language learning framed in that way, where it's not something that is just functional, that is supposed to help you get a job or something, but that it's something that you do because you are truly curious about another culture, or because you want to forge an authentic connection with the speakers of that language?
That would be great, yeah.
How beautiful would that be?
Yes, looking towards that wonderful future. I think we can. Thank you so much, Carly, for your time. This has been an absolutely delightful conversation. I've learned so much, and it's been really terrific. Oh,
thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This has been really fun. So, yeah.
Yeah, what great. A pleasure, thank you. Really.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. This is Catherine with a message from Carly. Are you faculty, staff, or administration at a higher education institution? Have you been trying to make your classroom or campus more linguistically inclusive? Or are you a current or former college student who is multilingual or uses historically marginalized Englishes or other languages? If so, Carly wants to hear from you for a research study. This is especially applicable if you are on a campus or in a course designed to support linguistic diversity. The purpose of this study is to collect illustrations and real-world examples in this space in order to inform current and future efforts to support linguistic diversity on college campuses. Please email Carly Overfelt at carlykoverfelt@gmail.com for more information and to set up a one-hour Zoom call. Please feel free to share and check out her email address in our show notes as well.
Thanks for joining us for this episode. You can find important links in our show notes.
This episode was produced by us, Catherine R. Matheson
and Sarah Kosal Agnihotri.
Our music is by Cube Sounds.
If you like our podcast, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Join us for our next conversation on L&D Loves Languages.